This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono is leading an effort to ratify a 40-year-old UN treaty establishing international rules for global maritime activity. The U.S. signed the pact back in 1994, but the Senate never gave the required two-thirds approval to make it official. The treaty's full name is the UN Convention for the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS for short. Senator Hirono spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about why she thinks that now is finally the time for the U.S. to become a full member.
I've been a supporter of the need for the United States to ratify this treaty for quite a while now. And generally, at least one or I or somebody on the the Armed Services Committee asks the military people whether we should join UNCLOS, and the response has always been, yes, we should. And what this treaty does is it basically lays out the parameters, you know, regarding the territorial and exclusive economic boundaries of what countries can claim as their own. And then if there are disputes, it provides a framework to settle these disputes.
And so what's going on in the world right now that made you want to bring up this issue at the present moment?
Both China what they're doing is they're basically building islands off of atolls in the South China Seas, and there are a lot of concerns about what they're doing in that part of the world. And so you have China doing various things that can interfere with free navigation, freedom of the seas, and then you have Russia trying to lay claim to various resources in the Arctic. And they both are members of UNCLOS. So the reality is that when there are disputes, one can go to an international tribunal. As the Philippines did, they went to The Hague, and China refused to participate. And when we, the United States, wanted to attend, we were not able to attend or participate in any way because we are not party to UNCLOS. In spite of the fact that there may not be legal remedies to the decisions, what happens is that you have the other members of UNCLOS who are able to take collective action to enforce the decisions of the tribunal.
Well, everyone out there listening might remember from civics class that for a treaty to be ratified in the United States, it has to be signed, which UNCLOS was in 1994, but then it also needs to be ratified by two-thirds of the U.S. Senate, which is the body in which you serve. And so that was 25 years ago that the treaty was signed. Why do you think that hasn't happened yet in the Senate?
It's a mystery to me at this point, because it's been a long time, and since then, believe me, both China and Russia have been very aggressive in what they're doing for Russia in the Arctic and for China in the South China Seas. So the times, they have changed, and we need to be part of this this treaty so that we can play what I hope would be a leadership role. And as I mentioned, even if an international tribunal fines for a country such as for the Philippines, they do not have there's not a mechanism for enforcement. And so enforcement happens when other parties, other countries to the treaty take collective action. And since we are not part of the treaty, it makes it very difficult for us to weigh in. And when the United States weighs in, I think it makes a difference in terms of the enforcement of the decisions.
I know there have been a few efforts over the years in the Senate to bring this to a vote for ratification. Do you have any idea about the arguments that were made against even taking a vote, let alone voting in the affirmative?
One that I'm aware of is that there are some who believe that somehow the United States would be giving up some kind of sovereignty rights by being a part of this international treaty. But as I say, if we don't like what is happening, there is a legal mechanism for resolving these kinds of disputes.
Your co-sponsor in the resolution to bring this to a vote is a senator from another coastal state, Alaska, Lisa Murkowski. What do you think the significance of this convention is to coastal states, and particularly Hawaii?
Well, clearly we want to see the freedom of the seas. And when China is setting up system where they're laying claim to a large part of the ocean in that part of the world that's not freedom of the seas. China is what we call a near-peer competitor, as identified in the National Defense Strategy, as is Russia. And so what China is doing basically our part of the world is of major consequence to us. And as you may know, that China is very much involved in the Pacific Island nations and getting in there with money and all kinds of ways to gain a foothold in Oceania. So that's a concern. And then, of course, for Russia, it's the Arctic, and that is a major issue for Alaska. That is why this particular bill that I introduced in the Senate, along with Lisa Murkowski, is co-sponsored in the House by Don Young of Alaska.
And what's the significance of it being co-sponsored in the House? Is any action required in the House to get this ratified?
No, but I think it's very important for the House to be aware of the realities of the situation in the South China Seas and in particularly in the Arctic. The more we become aware of the changed realities, the better.
We've talked a little bit about the national security aspects of this, but the treaty also deals a lot with economic issues, fishing
mm-hmm.
rights,
yes.
deep sea mining, that sort of thing. Would there be any changes to U.S. ships or U.S. Companies operating in the maritime environment if the United States was to officially ratify the treaty and become a party to the Convention on the Law of the Sea?
Basically, we subscribe to the freedom of the seas that's outlined in UNCLOS. And so we often have a presence in the Straits of Hormuz, for example, and other places to indicate that we have no intention of not making sure that you know we consider outside of the 200-mile economic zone to be not any country's prerogative or right. And so we make our presence known in that way. But as I say, there are other aspects to UNCLOS that would be beneficial to us. For example, we would actually have a seat at the table when certain disputes come before a tribunal.
And you mentioned that earlier, and so it sounds like in a lot of ways where the United States is abiding by the terms of the treaty but doesn't have any of the benefits in terms of enforcement and dispute resolution that come along with full membership.
I'd say that pretty much encapsulizes our situation. And so the way I look at it is, I would like to hear the articulation in a very real, factual way, those who oppose us joining UNCLOS, versus the military. All of our military brass have been very clear that they support our joining UNCLOS.
And what's your sense, Senator, about chances for success in the Senate, where I know your party's in the minority right now, and that puts you at a somewhat of a disadvantage in terms of moving legislation?
We're going to do our best. Yeah, this is one of a number of issues that I would love to move, and most importantly right now is that we should call Senate back so that we can vote on the gun legislation that had already been passed by the House. There are so many issues like this that should be brought to the floor of the Senate, which Mitch McConnell refuses to do as he is so committed to packing our courts. But that's a whole other story.
That was Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono talking to HPR's Roy Infinity about her push to ratify the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. You can hear Ryan's full report at hawaiipublicradio.org or later today on All Things Considered. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we look at a Hawaiian connection to one of the 1800s most lucrative maritime practices. Whaling ships and crews dominated much of the East Coast sea commerce in the 18th and 19th century. And in the early 1800s, American whaling vessels began arriving in Hawaii. In those days, the products derived from whaling hunts were used to make everyday items. Whale oil was used in lamps and for heating, and whale bone from the creature's massive jaws were used to make corsets, skirt hoops, and umbrellas. While whaling was a profitable business, it was also a dangerous one, to say nothing of the dangers of angering a 50-ton sperm whale overzealous whaling captains who instructed their ships to sail too close to a coral reef would often find their vessels shipwrecked. A number of whaling ship crews found themselves marooned in Hawaiian waters, and for today's quiz, we're asking for the name of the oldest wrecked Nantucket whaling ship found in Hawaiian waters. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
I became aware of public radio first when I was in graduate school. I was a very fast fan, and from that point on, every place that I've ever lived, I seek out the public radio station on the radio dial, even if I'm vacationing someplace. And if there's any drive involved, I'm looking for the public radio station where I go.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
If at first you don't succeed, try again. We're talking about a campaign to impeach City Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro. Under pressure, Kaneshiro is now on paid leave after receiving a target letter from the FBI. And while he initially resisted stepping away, it took action by the state attorney general to pressure him to step aside to avoid any conflict of interest. Tracy Yoshimura was prosecuted by Kaneshiro's office over gambling charges related to machines known as Sweepstakes Direct. Not once, but twice. Those cases were thrown out, and the 200-plus machines were ordered to be returned. But Yoshimura says that was back in December of 2017, and they've yet to be returned.
It's still in the Supreme Court waiting for them to release their order. We went before the Supreme Court in December of 2017, and, you know, at that time, the Supreme Court had shredded the prosecutors for their actions regarding the seizures and the civil forfeiture process after that. However, they still have not released their opinion.
And how many machines did they seize?
They have about 200, roughly about 220 machines
okay,
in custody
those,
right now.
Those are all Sweepstakes Direct?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I think I did one of the original stories on that many moons ago. But regardless of whether they're gambling machines or not, you have a situation now. You are relaunching the impeachment process. Tell us about that.
Okay, we're relaunching the process to recollect the signatures, asking people to provide handwritten wet signatures on each and every form. We're doing this to basically give the city and the court everything that they've asked for, whether we agree with it or not. As mentioned, since the court released their ruling, we found a section in Hawaii Revised Statutes that specifically prohibited the Corporation Counsel, Moana Yost, that's handling or overseeing the certification process. But anyway, that section of the Hawaii Revised Statutes goes along with what we had requested, which was a written policy from her indicating that the city, you know, is adopting or using exclusion that's provided in the section of Hawaii Revised Statutes which addresses electronic signatures. She refused to provide us with anything, basically refused to even answer our questions regarding that. That's something that we raised before the courts. Now, since then, we've found a specific section of the statute, Hawaii Revised Statutes, that prohibits any government, city, state agency, or department from invoking or effecting any rule, policy, or procedure without it first being published for public inspection. You know, we specifically asked for that because without a written policy, you know, they could just use their discretion at any time to abuse the system, which we feel that, you know, has happened in this situation, to purposely delay and stymie this process to impeach the prosecutor.
Okay, so you believe you found a new section of the law which will bolster your case?
Yes. I mean, it backs up the request that we had, which made to her, which was asking her to provide us a written policy, a previously adopted written policy by the city, which states that they do not accept electronic signatures. And, you know, besides asking for that and now finding this section of the Hawaii Revised Statutes, which says that they cannot refuse or invoke or enforce a rule or policy without it first being a published, you know, publicly published policy. We're waiting to file a motion for recon to put before Judge Crabtree, which allows us to introduce, you know, new evidence or additional evidence. And because we had specifically asked Deputy Yost to provide us with a written policy, if for whatever reason she didn't know, which we would find hard to believe, being that they are the city's attorneys, that she would not understand their own rulemaking and policymaking process.
Do you know when that's going to be filed or when you're going to go back to court?
What we're waiting for right now is for the judge to finalize it and release his final written order. It's been about 3 weeks since he released his minute order, and it still hasn't come out. And until it's finalized, we can't file the motion for recon, which is frustrating us again because it's, you know, causing a delay or holding us back from getting that point clarified. But in the meantime, because time is sensitive, we are, you know, going to go ahead, like I said, whether we agree or not, and just go ahead and give to this petition collection of signatures in a manner that gives the city and the courts everything that they're asking for.
All right. So how do you get the word out then to people who might have signed electronically the first time?
Right now we're using social media and, you know, putting it out to the various media sources, news outlets, to try and get the message out as to, you know, the roadblocks that we've been facing and the tactics that we've been facing.
So you're asking those same people to either come down and connect with you?
Re-sign everything again. We've created a website where there's a link that they can go to, you know, use that link to fill out the personal information using their computer. That way there we can make sure that everything's legible. Once they've filled out the personal information, they need to print the form and hand sign it with a wet signature and then mail it back to us.
Okay, and then how many do you need, and how many did you collect the first go around?
The first go around, we turned in 864, I believe, ended up collecting about 1,100 on change.org. And then we did another collection of signatures electronically using DocuSign, which provided a much stronger audit trail that, you know, has been accepted by courts, banks, financial institutions, businesses around the world. DocuSign has done over 150 million documents worldwide and never lost a legal challenge before.
And so how many did you collect on that?
That one there, we collected about 540.
Okay. And how many do you need?
500.
Okay.
And then, basically, basically, that one there, because as we were in the midst of that collection, we were going through, you know, the court hearings and stuff like that, and knowing that the city was pushing back against even a platform as strong as DocuSign, that we weren't really doing a really, really strong push to the people because we're afraid of, you know, having them get the public getting frustrated and giving up and walking away. And, you know, we feel that that's exactly what the city and Conoscero's attorney is trying to do.
Okay. All right. And then is there any other way that folks can contact you aside from online, or are we, will you be any place physically?
An email address them for to contact us at, which is impeachconoscero@aol.com, as well as my phone number I published online.
Okay. And are you folks going to be anywhere in the flesh collecting signatures?
Yes, we're making plans for that right now. We don't know exactly when and where, but we'll use the website again, impeachconoscero.com, to post messages of times where we'll be and on what dates.
And then talk about the deadline. You can say it's time-sensitive.
The reason it's time-sensitive is because if the impeachment is completed before December 31st, 2019, the replacement will be chosen by the voters. It'll go to a special election wherein the voters will be the one to select Prosecutor Conoscero's replacement. If the impeachment is completed after December 31st, 2019, it becomes a mayoral appointment.
That was Tracy Yoshimura, who is trying to impeach City Prosecutor Keith Conoscero and is relaunching a petition drive to collect the necessary 500 signatures. We did reach out to Conoscero's attorney, Bill McCorriston, for comment, but did not hear back as of news time. We've just heard about the relaunching of an effort to impeach City Prosecutor Keith Conoscero, and our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat have a related story. Reporter Yuyun Jung is on the line. Morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yes. So this issue of former Honolulu Prosecutor Peter Carlisle is something that folks have been interested in because he has said publicly many times that he would like his old job back.
That's right, but it's no longer clear if he qualifies because the city charter says that a prosecutor candidate has to have been actively involved in a criminal case for at least 3 years in the preceding 10 years before an election. It appears that Mr. Carlisle has not been actively involved in a criminal case in that time period. So he actually wants a court to decide. So he actually filed a lawsuit in July in First Circuit Court. So he's demanding that a court make that decision for him because actually the way that the election works is he has to self-certify, but he doesn't want to go up there and lie because he knows that he doesn't qualify. But the city doesn't think that a court should decide that matter because they think that he should just go through the process.
Yeah, and we should note that, you know, he is a former mayor, so he's been busy being mayor, you know, over the last decade, and then is in private practice. But I did hear that concern about him not having the necessary criminal requirement over that last 10 years.
But he did serve as, you know, prosecutor between, you know, 1996 and 2010. So, yeah, I spoke to a public policy professor at the University of Hawaii, and his name is Colin Moore. And Moore told me that he didn't think that it was in the spirit of the charter to disqualify people like Mr. Carlisle, because, you know, it didn't seem like, in his mind, that Carlisle was not qualified.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, my gosh, there have only been a couple of people in that office, and he's one of them.
That's right. So since the position became an elected one in 1981, there only have been three people in that seat. And one of them is Peter Carlisle. The other one is Keith Conoscero, who you just talked about. And the other one was Charles Marsland.
Right. So those gentlemen, very experienced. So experience has nothing to do with it. But I guess technically the law says, so it's real interesting to see how this is going to play out.
That's right. So technically the law says he doesn't qualify. So he has to seek some sort of remedy because he does want that seat. So he's filed this lawsuit in court, and the city has filed a motion to dismiss, essentially saying, like I said before, the court doesn't have jurisdiction over this matter because Carlisle did not go through the appropriate process to deal with all the administrative remedies. The nomination process hasn't even begun. It's February 2020 when they start accepting nominations for this race. So they're saying it's too early to even start this process. But I also spoke to Mr. Carlisle's lawyer, Megan Cowell, and what she's saying is that they're just going to have to go through this process all over again when the time comes. He wants to run. There's no question about that. So when he self-certifies, or if he has to self-certify, and, you know, of course, the other candidates are going to object because they know he's unqualified, according to the city charter. So they're going to object, and there will be problems. And then he's going to have to go back to court asking for the same thing. And then that would be a waste of time and resources, according to Megan.
How recently did he file this with the court?
This was last month, so in July, and the city also filed their motion to dismiss in July. So their motion to dismiss will be heard in October, but that's not a problem because the nomination process doesn't even begin until February 2020.
Right, and then you mentioned the other people that are interested in that office as well.
That's right. So the only person who has officially launched his campaign is R.J. Brown, who used to work for the Hawaii Innocence Project. He's also a former deputy city prosecutor. That's the only person that we know of that is officially running. The other people who have expressed interest are Loretta Sheehan, who said she would consider. That's the police commissioner. And Steve Alm, who is a former state judge. And then other people have expressed interest, including Megan Kaw, who is Peter Carlisle's attorney. Yeah, Carlisle said he would endorse her if he ends up not qualifying.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Interesting story. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Yu Yun Jung with today's reality check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
One ocean, one people, one canoe. HPR invites you to a screening of Moana Nui a Kea, the documentary of Hokulea's landmark worldwide voyage, and a Q&A with Hokulea crew members. Sunday, August 18th in Waimea on Hawaii Island, Sunday, August 25th in Honolulu, and Saturday, August 31st in Lihue. Reserve your spot at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Dawson.
Matching up volunteers with nonprofits and community groups. For the last 10 years, that's what the group Hands In Helping Out, Hi-Ho, has been doing. You might think, Hi-Ho, that's a familiar song sung by dwarfs in service to Snow White. Well, that's not so far off the mark. Sherry Kishimoto is one of the co-founders of the group.
Well, we got started as a nonprofit back in 2009. That's when we founded the organization. But our history actually goes back another 3 years. Some of my friends and I, we started volunteering together. So we started off with Relay for Life with the American Cancer Society. And we realized that we had a passion for volunteering. And so we kept doing it together. You know, it was a good reason to get together. It was a good reason to potluck after. So we decided, let's keep going. And we ran into some barriers. You know, sometimes nonprofits are short-staffed. So they're not prepared for you. Or it's hard to find something that's good for everybody and their interests and their time. And so as a group, we're finding ways to get through those barriers and kind of figure out, you know, how to best serve everybody in a way that's positive and that made them feel like they're having a meaningful experience. And so we thought, maybe more people are experiencing this, and so why not make this available to more people? And so we thought we could start a nonprofit quit our jobs, make lots of money. So naive, right?
Yeah.
But we did. We decided, yeah, let's take the plunge, and we did. And 10 years later, we're still going strong.
Okay, so now I ran into one of your members at a community outreach. It was the Kokua Kalihi Valley Pua Ride. Mm-hmm. It was a fabulous event.
Yes.
And it took a lot of volunteers.
It sure did, yeah. And so actually K-Vibe, they reached out to us and let us know that they had this event coming up and they wanted to get some support. And so, of course, we love Kalihi Valley. We work a lot with Ho'oluʻaina, which is a program of Kokua Kalihi Valley. And so we're happy to help. And it became a logistical...
A challenge.
Definitely a challenge, right? So many different stops along the route and making sure there's volunteers at each stop. And so we knew that we could do that well. And so we wanted to be able to help and support this amazing event. And so we gladly accepted. And, you know, we had meetings with them and we just kind of talked to them, you know, talked it through, like, okay, what is it that's going to happen? Here's what we think. And so we're able to really collaborate on that aspect.
So what's the message you want to get out to other nonprofit groups that might need your help marshaling volunteers for their event?
We are more than happy to help other nonprofits with their events. Our volunteers are reliable, they're hardworking, and most important, they really care about the missions of the nonprofits that we serve. And so all we ask is that other nonprofits realize that we are here to serve our volunteers, and we want to make sure that everybody has a positive experience. And so that's our top priority. And then in the meantime, we also make sure that the nonprofit is taken care of and that they have a point of contact through us. And it becomes an easier experience because we facilitate a lot of it, yeah, so that they don't have to be in charge of all 10 people. We're in charge of them and they can just talk to us. We like to interact with organizations that do a variety of work. We understand that everybody's different, so they all have different interests, they have different skills. And so we try to engage with as many nonprofits as we can, but also in a responsible way so that everybody is taken care of.
But what are some of the events that you folks have worked with over the last 10 years?
Oh, wow. Well, like I mentioned, right, we have done the community work day at Ho'oluʻaina, Kokua Kalihi Valley. We have also done events with Special Olympics, Hawaii Literacy, Hugs, what else? Lanakila Meals on Wheels. So we've done a whole lot of different things, and we're trying to get people just immersed in their community so that they can feel a little bit more connected, as well as like they have more ownership over what's happening.
And so where do you get your volunteers?
We really get them through word of mouth. So, right, we started as a group of friends and it's kind of just expanded through people's circles. And eventually some people have just kind of Googled volunteer and they have found us, which is amazing. But really it's been, I think the best thing for us is that it's through word of mouth because people already know that they're getting into something that somebody they trust really enjoys and has a good experience with. So they can visit our website, hiho.org, H-I-H-O.org. And we do have a link that, you know, people can sign up for our list. And we do, of course, require that everybody go through an orientation first. So it's an in-person orientation so that volunteer as well as us get to know each other a little bit better and have that connection before we go out into the field and trust each other to do good work.
Right. And so and some might have a particular interest.
Right.
Where they might want to volunteer, let's say, with a group that has a medical mission. So you try and match up the volunteers with the nonprofits. Is that how that works?
We do. But at the same time, we don't want to limit people. So we do let everybody know everything that's coming up, at least that goes through us, so that people can decide if they want to try something new or if they've heard of an organization and now they finally get to volunteer with them. So in that respect, we encourage people to try as much as they want to and as much as they're available for. At the same time, we're still expanding the nonprofits that we work with. So sometimes there may be a very specific interest that somebody has that we don't yet have a relationship with that organization, but if they share it with us, then we're more than happy to make the first contact and hopefully engage with that nonprofit. Right now, our focus is on those individuals who are looking for connection and community, and so we feel like we can do the most amount of good and the best service for people who fit into that category. And so we're definitely open to working with businesses if they're interested. We do have some fees for services, some of our big services that we provide. And then one of them could be engaging a really large group of people so that, one, they understand what their volunteer service is accomplishing, you know, just not just the impact that they have on the community, but also the impact that they have on the nonprofit, right? Nonprofits are small or can be small. And so the time that it takes for them to prepare, as well as the amount of staff they have to have on site. And so just making sure everybody's aware of what they're working with and making sure that it's a very responsible interaction, because we want to make sure that everybody walks away feeling good about it and knowing that a lot has been done.
What got you into volunteering? Did you grow up in a family where that was really emphasized, or was it a particular event that you maybe saw and got involved in?
Actually, I've been Christmas caroling with my family since I was in second grade. And so my dad and his two friends, all three families, we started Christmas caroling every year. And that
just for good cheer.
Just for good cheer, yeah. I mean, we love music, and my dad had actually reached out the first year that we went. He reached out to a bunch of different children's hospitals, and everybody was booked. So he called a senior home, and they're like, "You're the first group that's called to ask us. Please, please come." And so since then, it has been our heart, where our heart is to sing for the seniors and to be able to bring them some joy.
Oh, gosh. So, yeah, so you look where there's a void, and you try and fill that void.
Right. Right, because we understand that, you know, everybody has their passion, and we want to make sure, though, that everybody's taken care of as best as possible.
And that was Sherry Kishimoto, one of the co-founders of a group called Hi Ho, Hands In, Helping Out.
It seems like whatever I'm listening to at the time is my favorite. For instance, yesterday I totally loved a Radiolab story that made me feel like I wasn't alone in the world, somebody who'd gone through the same things I had. And then I listened to Wait, Wait and had a driveway moment that I just couldn't leave the car. Aloha, I'm Carol Kahn from Pauilo on the Big Island, and I'm a sustaining member of Hawaii Public Radio.
During the first half of the 19th century, American whaling fleets offered a major economic boon to Hawaii. Business was booming, but it was also highly dangerous, and if you were marooned at sea, then chances for survival were slim. The open seas surrounding Hawaii have claimed a number of ships from that era, and in 2008, maritime archaeologist Kelly Gleason came upon the anchor of an old Nantucket whaling ship while surveying the remote atoll of French Frigate Shoals. Now, this led to further exploration of the area and the eventual discovery of the wreckage of the whaling vessel Two Brothers, some 600 miles northwest of Honolulu. Now, most of the wooden vessel had disintegrated over decades of exposure to warm Pacific waters, but researchers were able to discover several metal whaling objects embedded in the nearby reef. The skipper of the wrecked vessel was Captain George Pollard, whose first ship, the Essex, had been sunk by a sperm whale only a few years prior to the sinking of the Two Brothers. Now, if you're an avid reader and history buff, then you might know that the sinking of Pollard's first ship inspired Herman Melville's Moby Dick. And luckily for Captain George Pollard, however, the sinking of the Two Brothers was far less dramatic than what Captain Ahab went through. And on a February night in 1823, the two brothers ran aground on a coral reef and its crew abandoned ship. Lucky for Pollard, he survived the ordeal. No winners today. We stumped you on that. And that's today's quiz. If you have one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're told that today, 98 years ago, a Hilo company opened its doors. HPM Building Supply marks the anniversary, embarking on a new venture to provide modular homes that was born out of a community need. Jason Fujimoto runs the family business today, and he reflected on the long history of a community helping community and a new housing venture called Hale Plus.
Yeah, my great-great-grandfather, Kametaro Fujimoto, he was a contractor himself and also had an entrepreneurial spirit. And back in the day, obviously wasn't very satisfied with his supply options and decided to start HPM. So HPM actually stands for Hawaii Planing Mill. And that's where we actually started off as a business that actually planed cans of timbers from the Pacific Northwest into construction-grade framing lumber.
Tell us then, this is a new venture for the company.
Indeed, a very new venture, but something that really leverages all of the different capabilities that we've built over our 98 history. So something that we're very proud of and obviously came out of the lava flow event from last year, but really leverages our supply chain, so all of our kind of our vendor relationships, our manufacturing capabilities, our design capabilities, to really kind of make Hale Plus, what it is, at this moment in time.
So share with our listeners what you were able to do for the lava evacuees, because for folks, on the neighbor islands, on the other islands, they may not have seen what you put up there.
Sure. So, right around the lava flow event, there was an immediate and urgent need for temporary shelters. And that's where we had an opportunity to partner with Hope Services, a community organization in Pahoa, and a contractor named Gilbert Aguinaldo. And they had a vision for basically putting up these, what you call micro shelters on the Hope Services land right in Pahoa in a very accelerated time frame. So really, this was an amazing effort because in 30 days, we were able to clear land, put in infrastructure, and leverage HPM's manufacturing ability to assemble and erect 20 micro shelters and then one community center, all within that 30-day time frame, which in Hawaii is a remarkable feat. And obviously, we had a lot of support from state government, as well as our local and county governments as well.
So how are you going to make this work then for these modular homes to be available across the state?
Yeah, so these were micro shelters, and the conversation quickly evolved to, so how do we support more permanent shelters for our community? And that's kind of what led into the whole design development and concept behind Hale Plus, which really, kind of revolves around the three tenets of, number one, it had to be affordable. Number two, how can we make it expandable or modular so a family can start off, based on their financial needs and their family size, at one point in time, but have the option of expanding it. And then lastly, how can it also be transportable? And these are the three tenets that we really focused our design development on over the last 10 to 12 months.
So what's your plan then for actually getting the manufacturing done here?
So right now we actually are pretty much complete with our first prototypes. We call it Gen 2. And it's actually on a couple of these customized trailers that we manufactured and designed, and we're actually testing them right now. This prototype, is actually already spoken for, so it will go to Hope Services, and right after this, we're going to begin production of our second prototype, which will eventually become kind of a model home sales office at our facility. So right now we're doing this kind of as we speak, and kind of in parallel we're also working on an expansion plan for our 13-acre manufacturing facility here in KL, where we can actually have a dedicated covered plant, and equipment and space to really scale and hopefully meet the demand in the future. This for us is really. It's a big evolution of our business in terms of the final end product. But again, it's not something that we're having to start from scratch, right? We already have, because we do hardware retailing, we do pro lumber, commodity distribution. We also have a facilities, land, and we do manufacturing already of building components, trusses, wall panels, metal roofing, pre-hung doors. This Holly Plus initiative really kind of combines all of these different capabilities into creating a finished product in the factory. So, we are investing capital. We are investing in additional resource and expertise, but it's not like we're a standalone, factory-built housing business that has to rely solely on that for its success now and into the future.
So what's your timetable?
Well, for the next maybe 6 to 8 months, we really want to focus our current production capacity on really helping community organizations, like Hope Services, with their different needs, whether it's helping homeless, creating elderly housing, whether it's teacher housing, ag housing. There's many different needs right now out there where people would benefit from, again, a very affordable, quick, modular, transportable solution.
Okay.
And once we, depending on how that goes and how long that takes, right now we're kind of issuing a broad release date for the public of, 2020. Our current facility, we have a vacant 5-acre adjacent parcel that we already own that we can dedicate to this expansion.
So you're good to go.
We're I think we're pretty set. And obviously, there's a lot of work involved in the layout, workflow, again, the right equipment, and different things. But those plans are being worked on right now.
So what do you think your great-great-grandfather would say if he knew you were taking it to this level?
That's a really good question. I think he would be proud. I think... when you look at our roots, our DNA of HPM as a company, it kind of goes back to the community and doing whatever we can to help and be an important part of our community. And I think this solution truly does provide an opportunity and an alternative to affordable housing and really meeting an underserved market and really helping Hawaii in a time when I think we are truly at a crossroads. And we need to stop the population decline, 2 years in a row, and really keep our local community here in Hawaii. That's really the end goal. So I'm not sure exactly what he would say, but I'm sure, he would be happy that this falls in line with, the philosophy and the heart of the company.
I mean, that's terrific that, you're a big island company and you have these deep roots. And again, like you said, working to help keeping the community together.
Yeah, that's why we're here. So again, we wouldn't be around without our community and without our customers.
And
we're here to stay.
So for this anniversary, are you folks going to have a party?
Yeah, every year we definitely try to celebrate. And I think we have our eyes set on the 100th anniversary, which right is on 2021. And I think for that, indeed, we will have a big party.
That was Jason Fujimoto, president and CEO of HPM Building Supply, which today celebrates its 98th year in the community. Happy birthday, HPM. that's it for today. Up tomorrow, we plan on rebroadcasting a show focusing on homelessness on the neighbor islands. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Call 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find it all on The Conversation page. Look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.